Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 506, titled The Road to Lugano, Part 2, More About the Bush Administration, the Underground Reich, and the Peak Oil Controversy, being recorded on April 10th of the year 2005. What we're going to be looking at in this program concerns the interlocking between a number of corporate interests. We're also going to be taking a look at oil shortages, real, feared, or deliberately fabricated. And we're going to be taking a look at the history of the petroleum industry, the Underground Reich, and ask whether the peak oil controversy that is being used to justify not only enormous price increases in oil, enriching a number of interests, but is also serving tacitly, at least, to underscore the aggressive foreign policy of the Bush administration. What we're going to do to begin with is to take a look at an excerpt from For the Record program number 248. This was recorded on Labor Day weekend of the year 2000. That was the kickoff to the 2000 presidential campaign. In that, on that weekend, I did a program, again, For the Record 248, Bush, the Political Heritage of George Bush, in which I excerpted a number of programs I had done about the Bush family and said that basically, if George W. Bush became president, we could expect to see a recapitulation of what his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather had done. Now, this, in turn, is an excerpt from For the Record program number 214, recorded in the spring of 2000. That program was called Trouble on Oiled Waters, Part 2, and it excerpts some material from the remarkable book The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. What we're talking about in the excerpt you're about to hear is a phony oil shortage that was generated in the late 1970s, and this involved collaboration between the petroleum industry, the Saudis, and George Bush's CIA, the elder George Bush's CIA, in order to create what was portrayed as a looming oil shortage crisis, which in turn was used to not only generate a phony oil shortage, which destabilized Jimmy Carter, but was used to justify the aggressive foreign policy of the Reagan administration with an enormous military buildup combined with tax cuts, which led to enormous budget deficits. This is what I said we could expect if George Bush became president of the United States. So let's jump back to Labor Day weekend of 2000, and in turn, we're going to revisit a program from the spring of 2000, my prediction about some of the things that would happen if George Bush became president. Even before Americans voted for Carter, the oil industry had launched a quiet crusade of its own in anticipation of a Democratic victory. In the last months of the Ford administration, the CIA had developed a series of papers on energy and oil issues. Just after his victory in November of 1976, Carter was shown a classified CIA analysis of global oil supplies. The old spies, unquote, we asked about this point, insist that the report had a powerful impact on Carter and helped to define his policies on the, quote, energy crisis, unquote. When Carter launched his National Energy Plan in April of 1977, he confirmed that the CIA had provided him with intelligence assessments which made dire predictions about future energy supplies in the Soviet Union. The CIA warning made front-page news. Quote, Russia would be importing oil from the Middle East by 1985, unquote. The Soviets would need to buy 3.5 million barrels per day, to be precise, whereas in 1977, they actually exported 1.5 million barrels daily. Quote, previously, the assumption had been that the Soviets would continue to be self-sufficient in meeting their oil and gas needs, unquote. In order to bolster his energy crusade, unquote, the president was using the CIA to whip up a public frenzy about a looming conflict in the Middle East between the Soviet Union and the United States. The Associated Press ominously reported that, quote, in a few years, the USSR will face an energy crisis that is likely to sharpen U.S.-Soviet rivalries in the Middle East, CIA analysts predict. In effect, the CIA was telling President Carter that the Soviet Union would face a domestic oil shortage in 1985, causing the worst energy crisis in American history. When the Soviets ran out of domestic oil supplies, They probably would look to the traditional oil suppliers of the United States, especially Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Our sources in the intelligence community say that the CIA's oil shortfall, unquote, probably was the greatest intelligence fraud in American history. James Jesus Angleton would have been envious. His vessel fraud had hidden one tiny corner of Allen Dulles' covert operations, but in the long run, the forgeries he passed to Presidents Roosevelt and Truman only had limited foreign policy effects. This refers to Angleton's forgery of some communications allegedly intercepted from the Vatican. Continuing, that's the reference to the vessel fraud. Continuing here. The oil fraud of the 1970s succeeded in getting the U.S. president to change his policy toward Israel and the Arabs completely and directly promoted the massive defense expenditures of the 1980s, all based on the false premise that the Soviets needed oil and were planning to invade the Middle East. Some of the former intelligence officers we spoke to were adamant that the CIA was not to blame. They claim that CIA contacts in the oil industry cooked the books on the Soviet shortage by feeding misleading data to the CIA. Quote, "The agency had grown fat and lazy in the Middle East," explained one of our sources. Again quoting, "The oil companies were a big retirement area for ex-CIA staff. There were so many ex-CIA working for the oil companies that it was easy to fake the data," unquote. Of course, ex-CIA is a term that should be taken with a generous dose of salt. Note also here that Jimmy Carter made a bargain with the devil, although he believed the CIA assessment and was sincerely deceived. Ultimately, his conservation policies were sabotaged, and Jimmy Carter himself was destabilized by, among other things, the inflation that helped to push him out of office and Ronald Reagan and George Bush in. Note that as we continue. Others in the intelligence community say that it was not the underlying data that were bad as much as the analysis that was skewed back at headquarters. Quote, "You have to understand who was screwing the Jews," unquote, one old spy told us. By the way, this refers to the petroleum industry's longstanding anti-Israel policy underlying the official pro-U.S. policy of the United States. Continuing. Underlying and in contrast with, I should say, continuing. Quote, "The whole phony scheme, the oil shortages, the predictions about Soviet troops in the Middle East, the Saudi arms buildup, all of that crap started coming out of the agency back in 76. The CIA told their boss what he wanted to hear, and in those days, the head of the CIA was an oil man." That, of course, was George Bush. Continuing, "Perhaps the truth was somewhere in between. The CIA field agents slanted the data a bit to suit the oil industry, and the analysts exaggerated a bit more, According to several of our sources, the scheme to manufacture phony CIA estimates and push them on Carter began in the last days of Gerald Ford's term. They claim that a cabal within the CIA realized that Carter would be the new president, produced the first phony report, and then promptly gave it to Carter as soon as he won, knowing how it would affect his view of the energy crisis. It should be recalled that George Bush was the director of the CIA at the time the oil scam was put in place in 1976. There is some evidence to suggest that it was Bush himself who passed the fake oil estimates to Carter. That, again, excerpted from For the Record 248 from the beginning of September of 2000, in turn excerpting For the Record 214 from the spring of 2000, and the text, again, was from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. What we're going to do next is we're going to delve into a very, very important book called The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben that was authored by the late Joseph Borken, who served with James Stewart Martin on the Antitrust Division of the Economic Warfare Section of the Department of Justice in World War II, aimed at breaking up the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that had helped to produce fascism in Germany and had attempted to bring it to the United States. What we're going to be looking at here is the genesis of the standard IG Agreement of 1929, one of the most important cartel agreements in history, in which the Bergius process for creating oil from coal, a way of synthesizing oil, was the focal point of a cartel agreement between Standard and IG. It gave Standard the right to exploit this in parts of the world. It also gave IG Farben in Germany the rights to exploit it in parts of the world, and it made IG Farben the second largest stockholder in Standard Oil behind the Rockefellers. That has subsequently been increased. This in turn gave IG Farben, the German chemical cartel, the backbone of Hitler's political and economic support. It gave IG Farben a much-needed block of capital to compensate themselves for the enormous capital expenditures for research and development into exploitation of the Bergius process. And I want people to note very carefully that one of the motivating factors for Standard Oil's involvement in this agreement was the fear in the early 1920s that, surprise, surprise, the world was running out of oil. Turning now to the crime and punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borkin. The two people you're going to hear about first are Hermann Schmitz, the financial genius of I.G. Farben, and Robert Bosch, another I.G. Farben official, who oversaw the development of the Bergius process. Although Bosch's plan was to rely on the financial resources of I.G. to develop domestic production, he planned to bring in an American company like Standard Oil of New Jersey as a partner in the worldwide exploitation of the process. Moreover, Standard had more than enormous financial resources. It had a huge and well-staffed research and development organization that had achieved important breakthroughs in petroleum technology. Standard, the dominant force in the American oil industry, was also one of its more imaginative members. Since the early 1920s, when depletion of the world's natural oil reserves first became a matter of concern, Standard had searched for alternatives to crude oil. It pioneered in testing shale as a commercial resource, and in 1921 it even purchased 22,000 acres in Colorado in the hope that a commercially adaptable method of extracting oil from shale could be found. And in a footnote, it says, in late 1916, the United States Geological Survey announced that after a three-year survey, the agency's experts had concluded that the Colorado hydrocarbon shale beds would yield more than 20 billion barrels of crude oil, from which more than 2 billion barrels of gasoline could be extracted by ordinary methods. Again, it's 1916, folks. Continuing. Standard was also exploring the feasibility of the Bergius process, since the United States, like Germany, had tremendous coal deposits. In 1922, Frank A. Howard, head of the Standard Oil Development Company, had sent a young assistant to Germany to study the Bergius process, but had been advised that it was still far from ready for commercial exploitation. Again, bear in mind that the fear in the early 1920s was that the world was running out of oil, or at least that's what we were being told. Continuing. In the spring of 1925, Bosch dispatched several senior BASF executives to the United States to explore the interest of the Standard Oil Company. BASF, by the way, one of the member chemical companies of the IG cartel. When they arrived in the United States, the BASF representatives were given a tour of the refineries in the New York area and then invited to lunch with the Standard directors. Wilhelm Gauss, spokesman for the BASF group, made a speech of thanks in halting English. He said that he'd been very impressed by the size and efficiency of the refineries and by Standard's new research and development organization. He then mentioned, almost as an afterthought, the progress that Bosch and his staff had been making in the development of the Bergius process, information that Bosch had specifically instructed Gauss to mention. Gauss suggested that Howard visit Ludwigshafen when he was in Europe the next spring to see for himself, and Howard accepted the invitation. In March of 1926, Howard arrived at Ludwigshafen as he had promised and was given a tour of the BASF laboratories, by now officially a part of IG Farben industry. He was stunned. Although Howard was the head of research and development of one of the world's largest and most scientifically advanced corporations, he reported that he was, quote, plunged into a world of research and development on a gigantic scale such as I had never seen, unquote. He was especially overwhelmed by BASF's experiments in synthetic oil. Howard fired off a message immediately to Walter C. Teagle, president of Standard Oil, then on a visit to Paris to come to Ludwigshafen without delay. Based upon my observation and discussions today, I think that this matter is the most important which has ever faced the company since the dissolution, the breakup of the Standard Oil Trust by a Supreme Court decision in 1911. The BASF can make high-grade motor fuel from lignite and other low-quality coals in amounts up to half the weight of the coal. This means absolutely the independence of Europe in the matter of gasoline supply. Straight price competition is all that is left. Unquote. The urgency of Howard's message brought Teagle to Ludwigshaven within a few days. An examination of BASF's high-pressure installation left him just as impressed as Howard. Quote, I'd not known what research meant until I saw it. We were babies compared to what they were doing. When Teagle and Howard retired to their quarters, they talked over the effect of the startling scientific developments would have on the world's oil industry, unquote. For Standard's own protection, it was obviously imperative to find a way for closer cooperation with IG. The vision of thousands of obsolete oil wells was enough of a spur. At first, Howard and Teagle considered the possibility of purchasing the world rights to the Bergius synthetic oil patents from IG. However, millions had already been spent on the process, and it was obvious that only a tremendous price would be acceptable to IG. At the moment, Standard was not prepared to make a large expenditure on a process that was still in the early stages of development and not yet ready for commercial exploitation. Teagle and Howard decided to proceed cautiously. They concluded that at least for the present, the most sensible arrangement was a simple partnership to develop and perfect the process without any large financial commitment. Bosch agreed in principle to the proposal. Although he would have preferred a broader agreement, it nevertheless was a concrete demonstration of Standard's interest. Until this meeting, Bosch had limited the hydrogenation project to a few experimental high-pressure furnaces. After the reaction of the Standard executives, he threw caution to the winds. On June 18th, he ordered a huge Bergius plant to be built next to the Haber-Bosch plant at Leuna. He had decided that the process was sufficiently advanced for IG to start mass-producing synthetic oil, 100,000 tons a year. It was a step that many IG officials considered financially imprudent in view of the fact that the process still had some way to go before it was perfected. But Bosch was too powerful to be thwarted. On September 1st, 1926, at the first stockholders' meeting of the incorporated IG, plans were announced for construction of the big new synthetic oil plant at Leuna. The wisdom of pushing the project seemed to be corroborated a few days later when President Coolidge's Federal Oil Conservation Board submitted its preliminary report on the question of natural petroleum conditions, unquote, in the United States. The board found that, quote, the total present reserves in pumping and flowing wells has been estimated at about 4.5 billion barrels, which is theoretically but 6 years' supply. Future maintenance of even current supplies implies the constant discovery of new fields and the drilling of new wells, unquote. Even the worst pessimists were taken by surprise by the six-year estimate. Shortly after the announcement of IG's new synthetic oil plant, Bosch himself arrived in the United States to begin negotiations with Standard. He was interested mainly in financial support. By now, Teagle and Howard realized that their enthusiasm and stunned appreciation of the hydrogenation process had reduced their bargaining power with Bosch. They decided to put on a counter-demonstration. Teagle invited Bosch to accompany him on his annual tour of Standard's vast properties. For 3 weeks, they drove across the United States inspecting Standard facilities. On the trip, it became clear to Bosch that the Standard Oil officials were not ready to make the large payment to IG he had expected. In mid-December, he returned to Germany without a definite agreement or financial commitment. Again, he slipped into the depression that periodically afflicted him. It took until August of the next year for Teagle and Bosch to reach a relatively limited understanding. Standard agreed to embark on a cooperative program of research and development of the hydrogenation process to refine crude oil. It also agreed to build a new plant for this purpose as soon as possible in Louisiana. In return, Standard was given the right to exploit the process in the United States and to share half of the royalties with IG on licenses to other parties. However, Standard was not entitled to exploit the process in any of its far-flung plants outside the United States. Modest as the arrangement was, the New York Times, in its news story of the agreement dispatched by its German correspondent, was almost euphoric about the possibilities of IG's synthetic oil process. Quote, "What experts in chemical fields admit is that the world is on the threshold of a new fuel era, and that the often predicted failure of the gasoline supply is now shoved centuries into the future. The discoveries in these fields are far more marvelous than inventions which enable rapid strides in the development of radio, other uses of electricity, and in airplanes," a prominent industrialist told the correspondent of the New York Times, unquote. It was estimated by conservative authorities, unquote, that 20% of the gasoline used in 1928 would be synthetic, and within a very few years, Germany would be completely self-sufficient. So great was the confidence in making synthetic oil, concluded the New York Times article, that the price for the synthetic fuel was expected to be less than that of natural oil imported from the United States and the Soviet Union. We're going to skip ahead. One thing that was kept secret from Standard Oil was the enormous problems that IG Farben had been having with the Bergius process, specifically the enormous research and development that they had sunk into this was threatening to bankrupt IG Farben, so they desperately needed capital. By the way, as we're going to see, this process was used to provide Germany with most of its fuel in World War II, and a very large amount of fuel indeed. Although it was not economically competitive with natural oil at that time, Germany was able to use slave labor to make up for that economic gap. Skipping down. What Bosch really wanted was a large lump payment from Standard to extricate IG Farben from its present financial difficulties and still enable him to continue the hydrogenation project in Germany. With the help of Hermann Schmitz, Bosch devised a counterproposal that he did not believe Standard could afford to refuse. He offered to sell the world rights to the Bergius-Bosch hydrogenation process for the production of gasoline. The only territorial exception was that the rights in Germany were reserved to IG. Obviously, the German authorities would never permit IG to surrender to a foreign company the German rights to a process so crucial to military and economic self-sufficiency. Even so, IG did not reveal to its government that it was selling the hydrogenation rights to Standard. As Bosch anticipated, Standard jumped at the offer. The parties negotiated their agreement in the manner of two great powers forging a treaty to divide the world into separate spheres of influence. They agreed to observe the sovereignty of each in their respective fields. In the words of the Standard official, quote, "The IG are going to stay out of the oil business, and we're going to stay out of the chemical business," unquote. To set up a mechanism to carry out the terms of the agreement, the parties agreed to create the Standard IG company, incorporated in the United States, owned 80% by Standard Oil and 20% by IG. This retained for IG a minority interest in any future success. IG then transferred the world patent rights except for Germany on the hydrogenation process to the new enterprise. In return, Bosch finally secured what he so desperately wanted. Standard turned over to IG 2% of its entire common stock, 546,000 shares valued on Standard's books at $35 million. By the way, this is in the late 1920s. It's a lot more money than it is now. Continuing. As a slight bonus for IG, Teagle agreed to serve on the board of IG's newly formed holding company in the United States, the American IG Chemical Company. So again, the Standard IG agreement about the Bergius process to create synthetic oil from coal was conducted in the shadow of a feared world oil shortage in the early 1920s. Skipping ahead, hardly had the IG-Standard marriage been completed than it received a series of staggering blows. The Great Depression, combined with the discovery of enormous oil reserves in Texas, dropped the price of oil so drastically that Standard abandoned any immediate hope for worldwide development of the conversion of coal into oil. The drop in the price of natural rubber was even more precipitous. Buna could not possibly compete. Standard's oil interest in Buna lay dormant until the clouds began to gather for World War II, and it took the Arab oil boycott in 1974 to rekindle Standard's interest in making gasoline from coal. Now, again, note that during World War II, most of Germany's oil was produced by the Bergius process in synthetic oil plants, chiefly the Leuna plant in what eventually became Eastern Germany. The fuel thus produced was not economically competitive with natural oil. Not only was natural oil a lot cheaper then than it is now, but also Germany was able to utilize slave labor. In For the Record program number 385, titled Formula for Disaster, we read some excerpts from a very, very interesting, quote, novel, unquote, by Steve Shagan called The Formula. As with other of Steve Shagan's book, the evidence would appear to suggest that his novels are actually ways of floating highly sensitive intelligence information that could not really be disclosed ordinarily. What the book is about is about the Third Reich's development of a catalyst which made the Bergius process economically competitive with naturally produced oil by making the entire process more efficient. And that formula became the focal point of an enormous element of cartel blackmail and political blackmail in which many powerful interests were manipulated by the petroleum industry in order to prevent that formula from becoming public, because that formula, had it become public, could have basically destroyed the international oil cartel and could have been used, therefore, as a tremendous element of blackmail over countries that produced oil as well as the industrial combines that marketed it. Again, I believe that that novel was in fact represented as fiction simply because it was too sensitive. Otherwise, this is what we're being asked to believe, that one of the most important cartel agreements of all time between two of the most important commercial enterprises of all time, Standard Oil of New Jersey and IG Farben, that cartel agreement, the Standard IG agreement of 1929 over the Bergius process, has had no applications whatsoever in three-quarters of a century since, except for Germany using it to develop most of their fuel in World War II. And you think about all those planes, all those trucks, all those tanks, that is a lot of fuel. And it simply does not make sense. Again, I believe that the formula discussed in For the Record 385 is in fact. And one of the things that we're going to be taking a look at inside, too, is the peak oil controversy. Once again, we're being told, now that George Bush is president, the world is running out of oil. We're going to be taking a look at what some of the elements that are involved in developing the peak oil analysis. And we're going to once again revisit the Leuna plant. And we're going to take a look at some very, very interesting maneuvering indeed. However, that will be on side two. Spitfire, www.spitfirelist.com, stocks all of the CDs and lectures that I've done over the years. They have a massive website with thousands of pages of printed documentation available, all sorts of services like a search function, links to many important websites, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, that you'll hear excerpted later in this broadcast, is featured for download for free on that website. Also links to many other websites, including two websites maintained by WFMU that feature the entire For the Record broadcast for download for free. www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery has the more recent shows streaming on real audio and also many of them on MP3. And there's a longer URL linked to both that address and to the Spit For the Record section of the Spitfire website that features the other shows available for download for free. And WFMU is now podcasting the For the Record shows. There's a link on the description for the Record 503 and subsequent programs that will give you the connect you directly to the WFMU podcasting website. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 506, The Road to Lugano, part two. More about the Bush administration, the underground Reich, and the peak oil controversy being recorded on April 10th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.